A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast.
And we're joined by our deputy web editor, Anoush Shakalian, who is fresh from Batley and Spen, which she'll be talking about with us later, but she's joining us for this section as well.
Hello.
What a treat for you, because we're going to talk about Brexit. What else? First of all, Stephen, I know that we're recording this just before the announcement of various committee chairs. Who doesn't love a select committee chair announcement?
Who doesn't indeed? I am actually... This is quite an interesting set of ones, because whatever happens, it will tell us a couple of things. One of the dogs which hasn't barked than people feared might happen when you elected select committee chairs is that the governing party would deliberately vote for bad candidates in order to
get easy scrutiny. Okay, so that hasn't worked out. So let's take the Home Affairs Select Committee, which I guess is the highest profile fight. So I think everybody's seeing it as a fight between, you said, your morning newsletter, which I urge people to subscribe to because of your excellent article about Football Manager, which we could probably talk about later. But it's shaping up into a fight basically between Yvette Cooper, who has inherited a kind of brownite slate, such as
the brownite machine to the extent that it is still fighting fit. And that is actually one of the interesting plot lines of this, right, is how she does will give us some idea of how effective that organisation still is.
Versus Chukwumuna, who's now become really the sort of standard bearer for what I would think of as kind of liberal Labour, non-Corbyn Labour. Although I did a panel with him at Labour Party conference, you know, he's accepted that free movement is probably going to have to just be junked. So he's not Mr., you know, kind of open to the world, free markets, free borders. So those are the kind of top two in kind of contention. Then we also got a personal favourite of mine, Caroline Flint.
I was going to say, don't rule out Caroline Flint. He said, you know, hostage to fortune there, seeing as our listeners will either be laughing to me or going, oh, how far-sighted. Because she's done this tax evasion stuff lately, she's had to work with a lot of Tory MPs. Tory MPs are where it is won and lost. She's been a Home Office minister. She does impress a lot of Tory MPs. So it's possible that she could surprise one or two people.
And is there anyone else who I've forgotten?
Paul Flynn.
So Paul Flynn, who is a grandee, a veteran, and recently retired from, at the age of, I believe, 81, doing two front bench jobs for the first time ever in Corbyn's kind of slightly hastily cobbled together candidate. Again, as you observed in the morning email, lots of people seem to have nominated him who I don't think will carry on through and vote for him. Because they don't remember August 2015 and in the same deep, scarring way that the rest of us do.
Well, I do find it kind of funny that both Kate... Well, one of the interesting things is that two of the factions of the Parliamentary Labour Party that are completely neglected in most commentary, one is Birmingham, right? The Birmingham MPs, despite having fairly different politics, tend to be quite pally and to vote as a bloc. The other is the old, which makes more sense. If you think about it, if you're the only person in the 87 intake still left... The only person in the 1992, the only person in the 1970 intake, you're going to pal around with your other old mates, right? And so the nominations for both Kate Hoey and Paul Flynn have come from two places. Odd elderly MPs. I don't mean that as in. I mean as in ones who.
You mean odds and sods rather than weird.
Yeah, I don't. MPs. I don't. Yeah. So some of them are strange, but there is no particular reason why, say, Geoffrey Robinson would nominate
former
Paul
owner
Flynn,
of the New Statesman.
Yeah, they don't really share politics.
His blessings be upon him.
What they've got in common is they've been in Parliament for a long time and a lot of their mates have retired or died.
Okay, so you mentioned Kate Hoey, which brings us then neatly onto the Brexit committee. So the runaway kind of favourite in terms of nominations and sort of block support for that is Hilary Benn. However, I thought it was really interesting looking at people who nominated Kate Hoey. So Kate Hoey, Vauxhall MP, one of the few Labour leavers, there's still quite a lot of resentment in the party that she gave a cross-party gloss to the Leave campaign, right? When everyone, pretty much, apart from her and Gisela Stewart and a couple of other people like sort of Frank Field and Dennis Skinner, they're, you know, the PLP was overwhelmingly in favour of Remain. So I just think there are still some people who are kind of still quite angry with her for getting on a boat with Nigel Farage.
Yeah, although there is a slight double standard here in that most people are not angry with Gisela because people really like Gisela. She's hugely respected on both sides of the House, etc., etc. And a lot of Labour MPs have never liked Kate Hoey, right? Mm-hmm. They feel that she is, yeah, she effectively endorsed Boris in 2008. She did a very good job of not doing anything which broke the letter of Labour's rule book, but she pushed the spirit pretty damn hard.
She gave a really fascinating quote yesterday. I can't remember exactly what it was on, saying, "I've always been somebody who looks at the position evidence and then take a position. I don't take partisan positions." And I thought, hang on a minute, what are you doing in the Labour Party then? Like, yeah, that sort of, you've missed the point of not being an independent MP at that point. Mm. But they're also, Clive Lewis nominated her as well, which I find very tempting to see that as a kind of, "I'll get you, Hilary Benn," kind of like a sort of slight amount of revenge for the coup in the summer.
Yeah, that did feel slightly personal. I mean, those are the votes that Kate will get. She will get the votes of Eurosceptics, diehard Eurosceptics. Obviously, you know, she will do better than many expect. It won't necessarily be a walkover. She'll get at least 80 votes, I'd guess. And she will also get the votes of people who are incredibly loyal to the leader's office. If I were feeling inclined to troll our listeners, I might suggest that there was a somewhat of a commonality between Eurosceptics and loyalists to the Labour leader, but
that's a take that back. No one loves Europe more than Jeremy 7.5 out of 10 Corbyn. Finally, the one that I know you're excited about, science and technology.
It's a five-way between five Conservative MPs, which is, I mean, I don't think anyone knows how that's going to shake out.
Is there any kind of factionalism involved in it? Is there anything that you can read into who actually wins?
No,
just who's nicest, who they like most.
I think particularly when it's sort of a five-way and it's, and who gets knocked out first, and it's all going to be very weird. I think it's mainly going to be an interesting guide as to who has mates and also who has done a good job of wooing the other parties.
Well, while we're talking about committees, the other thing we must mention is cabinet committees, of which there are five. Theresa May is chairing four of them. David Cameron chaired two of them. The obvious piece of criminology to take from this, I think, committees are a ripe subject for criminology, is that Theresa May, who was known at the Home Office as not being one of Nature's delegators, is again keeping a very tight grip on things. I'm really surprised. There is a kind of, it feels like we're living in a slightly weird news drought. I think Matt Chorley, and his rival to your email, sorry, I cheated on your email, has pointed out that Jeremy Corbyn only makes it into one piece in the Mail today. So the leader's office, the Labour leader's office, is not pumping out stuff. At the same time, Theresa May's office is not pumping out stuff, which has a slightly weird feeling about all of this kind of, people really scratching around for things to say.
Yeah, it definitely is was a very thin morning, which I think was more obvious in Redbox than it was in my email.
Sassy.
But there is a bit of a news drought. The problem, of course, for the opposition, as it is always the case for oppositions, is that unless you're having a fight among yourselves, or you have a large poll lead and people therefore look to every pronouncement you make as the words of the next Prime Minister, which we forget, even though at this stage Ed did have that advantage, you mostly get shut out. The government has gone very silent on lots of things, I think because they've realised that they have a tiny majority, although that has got a bit bigger because they've successfully wooed some of the DUP to a point where you could now sort of plausibly say they start with a majority of 32.
But that's the interesting thing, is that they can control to some extent the domestic stuff, but they can't control the fact this is a negotiation with 24 other countries, right, and the EU and all the people there. I mean, it's been interesting to see, you know, the Republic of Ireland, for example, has been talking in very worried terms about how they're going to deal with with this. You know, you've been hearing noises from MEPs and others in the EU about how worried they are about this. They can only control what they can control, right? And I think this might be quite a bruising couple of months. I think, do you see more evidence for our early election thesis came up yesterday?
Did it?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. Oh, the Heathrow decision being kicked until 2017. So you can absolutely make sure that you get a much bigger majority next year, and then you've got no problem with a couple of refuseniks who won't vote for it, or giving people a free vote on it.
I don't know. I mean,
I'd love to be able to read things into Heathrow being kicked into the long grass, but it's happened so many times now that I don't know.
Like a lovely annual tradition.
Take anything from it at all. But it's a good example of why the government has been so quiet, actually. Grammar schools, although they were sort of forced to make a pronouncement on that because it was leaked, and Heathrow, just opens them up. They're very vulnerable anyway because of the EU negotiations, and because they've got so many dissenters on their own benches, that when they try and announce something domestic, they're open to perhaps more dissent than they otherwise would be, because you get people who are so angry with what they're doing in Europe that they're happy to speak out against the government on domestic issues as well.
That's why. I mean, we've got the autumn statement coming up on, I've got to say, I think it's the 23rd of November, but I don't know why I've got that date.
It is all the 24th, but it's actually semi in autumn this year.
So. There's allegedly a white paper coming on prison reform, the long delayed one. Who knows what that will be if eventually will be left in it. The NHS doesn't look like it's getting any more money. I mean, I think this is the thing, is you can only kind of keep a lid on everything else for so long. Before we move on, and I'm... I know we really want to talk about these by-elections. I just want to bring up Stephen, Championship Manager.
Yep.
Explain to us why it models Brexit better than politicians and commentators.
Well, I think because they actually have sat down and worked out what the three plausible models for Brexit are. Football Manager is a game in which you are a football manager. You don't actually have to control the little men, and sadly, a lot of the time, it feels like they control you. And they've realised, and although obviously mostly Football Manager eschews political developments, although they do take note of the visa requirements to control how likely your work permits are to fail, they have understood that.
See, I really love this. I gave up, as it was then, Championship Manager in 2003 when I was still playing the 97-98 season. And that was about the level of complexity that I was prepared to read. Like, how good is man at kicking ball? How good is man at heading ball? And now I hear there's all kinds of other stuff. Like, you have to look at their nutritional information and what time they get to bed. And
you know, your scout quality clubbing and all of that. There is an awful lot of complexity in it now. But one of the things they have completely got is Brexit is our national project, right? It is going to define politics, not just for the next 2 years, not yet for the next 5 years, but for all of our working lives. We will be reporting on, or being shaped by, or both, the consequences of this vote. And a lot of people, including people who voted Remain in the political class, still seem to have this bizarre idea that, it'll be a bit gnarly. It'll be a bit like, it'll be...
Like 2 years we'll chat about it, but then it's over, so it'll be done. Yeah, I know, I don't. My worry is that it's going to get really nasty. I've written my column this week in the magazine about this sort of language of traitors and like a lack of patriotism, that why aren't you getting behind Brexit? And I just feel like it reminded me so strongly of... the kind of language that we used about people who didn't get behind the Iraq war. There was a Daily Express article that said, these snakes, I used the word snakes, who don't get behind it should be locked up in the tower. Classic op-ed lines of our time. I'm going to start throwing that into everything. And anyone who doesn't agree with me on NHS reform should be thrown into the tower. But then I went back and I found a Sun front page about Charles Kennedy and the Lib Dems' opposition to the war. And they put him next to a picture of a cobra. And they said, one of these is an unprincipled reptile that spits venom. And the other's a snake. Because, lol. But, exactly that same kind of language. That if you're not on board with what the government wants to do, then, conflating the idea of supporting the government with support, with loving your country. And I think that's going to get really, really quite nasty. Added to which, all this stuff about the we're taking this pitiful number of refugees, and even that has kind of provoked massive amounts of wailing and gnashing of teeth. Mm. I think that this is going to be a very unpleasant couple of years. But we will return to this in a moment.
Hi. Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now Anoush Kalian joins us again to talk about by-elections. This is the kind of the Hostage to Fortune special podcast, having talked about the select committee chairs, which will all be out by the time people listen to us. Anyone who's listening to us at the weekend will know the results. So there's two by-elections on Thursday. First is in Batley and Spen, where Joe Cox was murdered last year, the MP. As a sign of respect, Lib Dems, Conservatives and UKIP haven't run any candidates. Let's talk about that one first, because that's the one that you've been to. We'll talk about Whitney in a minute. What was it like? What was the mood in the constituency?
It was quite a muted, somber mood, as you can imagine. Although most people were very willing to talk about what had happened, it wasn't as if they had sort of journalist fatigue or news fatigue, which I thought might be the case. But also there is a sense among lots of the voters that I spoke to, and even some of the people on who had been out campaigning, was that they wished that the main parties were running their own candidates, although it was a sign of respect that they didn't. Now that it's come to the by-election a few months later, the voters do actually want someone to vote for who's not a Labour candidate. The majority of voters didn't vote for the Labour candidate, for Joe Cox, last time. And so there's a lot of people who are feeling a bit lost and a bit unrepresented. A few people are going to be lending their votes to Tracy Braben, who's the Labour candidate, even though they're not traditional Labour voters, because they like her. She's a local figure. She's well known. She's an actor who's been in Coronation Street and other soaps. And also she was a friend of Joe Cox, and there's a lot of respect for Joe Cox's work around there. But there are people who wish that there was a Tory or a Lib Dem candidate to vote for, because now the vacuum's been filled by some candidates from far-right fringe parties who have leapt on the opportunity to get a bit of publicity.
Well, let's talk about this, because this was one of the things, I mean, you know, to peer behind the curtain a bit. I mean, we had a discussion in the office about going up to cover and who we would like to cover this, because I think it's difficult when you know that you are going to cover people who, you know, some, they will be hostile towards journalists. And I mean, I remember, you know, having to phone the BNP for comment on stuff, and you just kind of get this like long diatribe about how all teachers are Marxists and you ought to be at home cooking cakes for your husband. I mean, tell me a bit about some of these other parties that are running.
Yeah, so it's mainly the... So UKIP has decided not to run. So it's parties to the right of UKIP, the BNP, the National Front, the English Democrats and Liberty GB, which I think is another far-right one that I hadn't really heard that much about.
Yeah, I think during the fallout, because when Nick Griffin did Question Time, one of the things which annoyed people in the BNP was him laughing and joking with Bonnie Greer.
People were annoyed that he was insufficiently racist, basically.
Yeah, and I think I may be wrong, and I'm sure this is one of those things where one of our academic listeners will be able to correct me, and I will do a parish notice in the next. But I think Liberty GB is one of the break-off organisations that came out of the feeling that he was being too chummy to Bonnie Greer.
Yeah, there are a few splinter groups and also independent candidates who are also from the far right. So there's someone who's changed his name by deed poll to Corbyn Anti, so that it comes up as Anti Corbyn on the ballot paper. And he's someone who is an English Democrats member, but he's not getting behind the English Democrats candidate. He's running on his own. So, you know, I mean, they're sort of fringe people. They're not big figures, and it doesn't seem like they've got any significant support in the area. Although the area has had a bit of far-right flirting in the past. So Dewsbury is a town nearby, and that's had EDL marches, and that's had BNP councillors. And and Batley in Spen actually has had a few BNP councillors about a decade ago as well. And Nick Griffin actually went up to the constituency to visit it, and he called that area the jewel in the BNP's crown or something like that. So that's something that is in the memories of local people. But I didn't pick up very much anti-immigrant sentiment at all, actually, when I was walking around. And that might be because of the very unusual circumstances of the by-election.
Yeah, I would have thought it's not... I mean, it's kind of one of those things where I think there'll be a certain repressive effect on people telling you that that's...
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure people are a little bit more watchful of their words than they might be in constituencies nearby or with the same kind of demographics.
It is really interesting. I mean, just as a general point about hard right and far right parties, that how thankfully prone to splintering they are, much as parties on the far left do. I just because I want to bring this in as a minor rant of my own, Stephen Wolfe has now left UKIP. He's withdrawn his bid for leader. I think UKIP had a huge turnover. You'll maybe know this, Stephen. 2015, whenever the last elections were, but ending in 2014, that parliamentary session, about seven of them left and stood as and sat as independents in the European Party, right?
Yeah, I mean, they've always... UKIP have always had this problem, and whenever they've had an electoral advance, they've splintered and started fighting among themselves. Of course, they've had the biggest...
One hell of an electoral advance.
The biggest victory the biggest single victory, I think, of any political movement in British politics, probably since the suffragettes. And they are probably going to keel over completely. But the weird thing about people like Stephen Wolfe is they actually only joined in 2011. They were kind of part of sort of the kind of second Farage era of more professional-looking people coming in. I mean,
I think that's interesting in that when you look at the UKIP leadership contest now, you know, you've got people like, again, like Suzanne Evans is another example where you just think, well, you could probably be in the Tory party, right?
Yeah.
But whereas you've got, on the other hand, you've got... David Coburn, the MEP in Scotland, or you've got some of the people. I was on the Sunday Politics with a guy in a splendid waistcoat, who's another one of their MEPs. Raheem Kassam, who may be familiar to some listeners for his time at Breitbart. It's always good to see someone in Breitbart getting involved in politics. Literally nothing bad ever happens when that happens. But you know, so I think it is now kind of shaking back out to its more wilder fringes.
Well,
right?
Yeah. I'm surprised that you think that they're going to implode. Why do you think that? I think it's going to be the opposite.
I mean, I think, one, because I think they're going to continue fighting among themselves, whoever emerges as leader. The second is they've got this big financial meteor coming into them, which is the end of the European Parliament. The only place that they've ever been able to get elected has been the MEPs because of its proportional nature. A lot of them are employed by people. So the slight weirdness, if Suzanne Evans becomes leader, you'll have a situation in which the leader of the party, her paid job is being a parliamentary aide to Douglas Carswell, who we haven't slagged off for a while. So I'm just going to say, Douglas Carswell, what a jeb end.
Can I say that I've got no hate left in my heart for Douglas Carswell because it's all taken up by Daniel Hannan, who I've become like, he's all my... anger over Brexit has been distilled into one handy human Daniel Hannan shaped form with his tweets about elderberries and like how the Battle of Hastings was England's Nakba. I find him kind of compelling and horrifying at the same time. But to exactly to your point, I attempted to start a Twitter beef with Daniel Hannan saying, you said that you wanted the British people to vote to sack you. They did. Why are you still there collecting your €9,000 a month, mate? And he deleted his tweet and then didn't reply, which was sad. But the same thing about Stephen Wolfe. So Stephen Wolfe has to stay there until 2017 in order to be eligible for his golden parachute back out again. And this is a fascinating thing about, yeah, UKIP. No one has benefited more from the absurd signing in rules and and massive amounts of expenses of the European Parliament than UKIP. And Aaron Banks, who we profiled in the magazine last week, a really brilliant piece, you know, put huge amounts of money into UKIP and is now quite willing to put them somewhere else. I see UKIP a bit like Libya, in that the strongman was holding them together, right? And you might think you want to bring down the strongman, but that does leave a power vacuum that is then filled by competing groups.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I don't think there are any Islamists in UKIP. That's the important thing that I should say is different.
But yeah.
I see them more as a party on the up having growing pains than a party that's falling apart. Because I just think there's a huge chunk of voters now who won't go anywhere else but a party like UKIP. And I don't know...
No, I think that's exactly it. A party like UKIP, I'm just not convinced that UKIP... What is the essence? What is the soul? Where's the power vested? You know, Labour's got the NEC, which will always kind of hold it together. But actually everyone in UKIP hates their NEC and thinks that it's rigged against Nigel, who is the other kind of centre of gravity, right?
Yeah, but I think there's a few quite respected and sort of convincing local candidates who have done well in UKIP-y seats over the past few elections, local elections and the general election. And I think they're not going to go away because they're the ones who are, it's sort of like a grassroots up type thing. And as the country gets poorer and as people suffer more and as people realise that problem isn't necessarily migrants, And there's still going to be immigrants, whether or not they're Eastern European immigrants or non-EU migrants who are taking up the jobs in those areas which need jobs, because that's where the migrants go. They're either going to still have all of these people to blame, or they're not going to understand why they're still worse off 5-10 years after Brexit. And I don't know where that sort of dissatisfaction, that kind of vote, is going to go unless it's to a party like UKIP.
That, no, I agree. I think we all agree. Like, yeah. That's the thing. We all agree that there is space for a party like UKIP. I mean, like, I think it's probably an English nationalist party, because UKIP doesn't do very well in Scotland. Obviously, it doesn't run candidates in Northern Ireland. It's done... I mean, this
does
is...
does very well in Wales.
It does very well in Wales, despite Neil Hamilton being involved.
Well, the thing is, I think it might go into a zombie state, because I think you're exactly right. There's clearly a... to burnish my Blairite credentials. Things don't go bust if there's a market for them, right?
Yeah.
It's why all of this will Labour die thing is nonsense, right? There's people want a left-wing alternative to the Conservatives. And so even if Labour dies, something like the Labour Party will emerge, which is capable of challenging the Conservatives. And as Wales has shown, you don't need to be UKIP to be successful for it to take a lot of votes, because exactly as you say, it's about what do they offer that no one else offers. As people get poorer, we know that actually mostly does help the right, not the left. So you'd kind of expect them to survive and thrive. But if their major donor is giving money to someone else, and we forget that UKIP is really the Nigel and Gawain Towler show, their head of comms, very polished operator, used to be a Conservative, hugely respected by telly producers.
That's one of the great UKIP stories of our time. Any new party should take that lesson from them, is that they would turn up to anything. They would always have their thing. They would always say the same thing they said on the phone. They would be no trouble, and they would say something, that was distinctive, and they would leave again. And this is something that, actually I think parties like the Greens could probably learn from, is that they just made being on they were every TV producer's dream booking, right? And that meant that they got a lot more bookings.
Yeah, and their press offices are really great, very accommodating.
They're
happy to give interviews to anyone.
But this is the thing, they genuinely...
Whether it's someone from the New States.
They're happier to talk to us than sometimes the Labour leader's office have been to to press on the left, which is kind of fascinating. We must just quickly talk about Whitney, which I think is a really interesting constituency, David Cameron's old constituency. Thing I did not know about Whitney, 54% voted Remain.
Yeah.
So it is a rural Remain constituency, which there are not very many. The big test I would contend there is the battle for second place, right? And whether or not we are going to see a hashtag Lib Dem surge.
Yeah, because the interesting thing is one of the unreported stories, this is interesting use in a way that only Stephen Bush uses it, I'm afraid, but is the Lib Dems have been doing very well in places which meet the following criteria. In the South, very affluent, Conservative voted Remain. Whitney, obviously, is all of those things. You would expect them to... If this Remain surge, and there is some evidence in by-elections they are getting, is real, you would expect them to place second in Whitney. Hopefully,
we should say that Labour came second in 2015 and they're running the same candidate.
They are running the same candidate, but it was a very distant second. What it was really about is they clearly worked it hard, but it was partly about the overall collapse in the Liberal vote, which went two ways. So you'd kind of expect the Lib Dems to, if things are going well, to be able to place second, perhaps even to have a very good second. It will tell us a lot about the success of their kind of, you could call it a 22% strategy. They want that
hard anti-Brexit. I also think that they've thrown the kitchen sink at it in terms of campaigning, right? And that's another thing that's interesting, is that they've been all kinds of, Nick Clegg's been there, Paddy Ashdown's been there.
Yeah, they've kind of made that by-election a story about them by doing all of that. So I don't know whether that could either work really well for them and people will be looking out for a Lib Dem surge, or it could massively backfire and they will come third and it will represent the fact that this strategy isn't working.
The thing is, they really do have to place now. The other element of all this is, one, they thought they would be fighting a snap election, so they were all geared up, so they kind of thought, might as well. The second is Heathrow, which we talked about briefly, which may trigger a by-election in Richmond Park, which they held until 2010. It's also partly about effectively, they had this open beta for their by-election machine, which is one of many reasons why, if Zach Goldsmith runs as an independent Conservative, particularly if there is a Conservative candidate,
Perhaps write a blog on this?
I did write a blog on this, yeah.
that was then rendered redundant by Theresa May kicking that can down the road.
Yeah,
and
I then decided to like repurpose some of it and just publish it anyway. But yeah, I'm feeling bitter about this, so I'm gonna. But yeah, and that is another element of it. Of course, it could turn out that we're all completely wrong, and by the time you're listening to this, the Lib Dems have come a humiliating fourth place.
Mm. Ooh, behind the Greens. Behind Bernie Sanders' brother.
Stephen and I have often discussed this, is that there is a tendency for people who watch politics closely like we do to overestimate the Lib Dems. Normal, they're like, oh no.
The Tim Henman of politics, in a way. You just think they're kind of scrappy and they try really hard. And
this is the point that I sort of nicked from Anoush for my What I Got Wrong last year, because you made the point, whenever you wanted to impress like your non-political friends, they go, oh, no one's going to vote for the Lib Dems. And you're just like, oh, actually...
They're doing really well locally.
Yeah. It's like, what you don't understand is... And it turned out, of course, that we were completely wrong. And then all of your... Like, everyone's non-political mates were like, no one is going to vote for these guys, were 100% correct.
But the question, I guess, is for them whether or not Brexit is their Iraq War Mark II, right? Which is that they are just... There are some people in the country who feel incredibly strongly about this and don't feel that... And this has now become the one thing that they're sufficiently angry about. And actually, you know, you call it a protest vote or whatever you want, but... That will be the big... This is truly a week of great Kremlinology, and that this will be another part of that. Thank you for joining us, Anoush, in our podcast bunker. And hopefully have you back on soon.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by Helen Lewis and me, Stephen Bush, and produced by India Bork. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.